you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 235 of Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. Today, my guest is Thomas Howlett. Now, Thomas has been a fan of the program from the very beginning, as he mentioned to me offline. He says he's listened to more episodes than I have recorded because he's listened to several episodes multiple times. So that's a real fan, and I'm very appreciative of his support and his willingness to share that. We're going to talk with Thomas, who is a catastrophic injury attorney, personal injury attorney in the state of Michigan, who at one point lived here in the Washington area and also lived in tropical paradise. We'll get into that in a little bit. About being an attorney general for the government in a small island nation in the South Pacific. So really cool stuff. And we talk with Thomas about his perspective as an attorney joining an established, venerable firm in Michigan, and how the practice of law has changed and how he has adapted to the realities of the new situation, particularly here with the pandemic, but more specifically, or more generally rather, to technology and the workplace and the internet and all that kind of good stuff that we like to chat about. So without any further delay, here's Tom Howlett. Tom Howlett, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thanks, Neil. Thrilled to be here.
Well, it's really great to have you on the show. We've met a couple of times before, and so I'm thrilled that you could take the time to be here with us today. Tom, tell our audience a little bit about how you came to be where you are today.
Happy to do that. So I am in Michigan, where I have been practicing law in a plaintiff side litigation firm for about 20 years. Thought I was going to be a professional journalist and practiced in journalism for several years before going to law school. Went after law school to your fair city, Metro DC, where I practiced for a number of years. And my wife and I then lived overseas and did some law in an interesting tropical paradise for a couple of years. But for the last 20 years, I've been representing catastrophically injured people and victims of malpractice, trying to tell their compelling stories here in Michigan.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about you think you're going to write and work in the journalism industry. I thought I was going to have three other careers before I ended up coming to law. You know, so I tell people that I'm still trying to figure out what I want to be when I grow up. And journalism is kind of interesting. When I went to law school, we had a couple of journalists in the class. And just by way of an aside, I remember the guy spoke up in class that one time, and that was the first time I'd heard the term blog. I had no idea what he was talking about.
Well, I think I went to law school a little bit earlier than you because, because blogging came to being while I've been practicing law. But when I was a journalist, we were still dealing with kind of the first generations of computers and the like.
Yeah, it's funny when you look at some of those the movies like you know, the quintessential one, All the President's Men, as an example. And you see those gigantic word processing terminals on everybody's desk in the newsroom.
Yes, exactly.
I'm assuming that's a kind of where you were at with that.
Absolutely. And a power trick.
Dot matrix display showing, you know, one character at a time being typed out.
Right. Well, we had in the Dallas Morning News newsroom where I spent almost 3 years, we actually had one computer for two journalists, and it was kind of on like a lazy Susan, and you spun around to take turns working on your stories.
Right. Well, again, I'm just going to tell old war stories here. When I first worked in the tech industry, worked as a systems engineer. That was when the PC was just coming online. We had an IBM PC on a cart that you wheeled up and down the hall, and people took turns using it. That was our first portable.
Yes. And we each now have, what, 3 or 4 computers probably within arm's reach of our conversation here that are more powerful than what they used to get people to the moon, right?
Well, that's exactly correct. My iPhone has more computational capability than the IBM 360 that we used to generate orbital trajectories for when I worked at NASA.
So we have nothing to complain about.
No, we have nothing to complain about whatsoever. Whatsoever. So you went to law school, you worked in firms, you worked around, worked in paradise for a little while, as you said.
Yes.
Did you always have the idea that you wanted to be a solo or small firm practitioner, or, you know, did big law attract you at some point once you finally got into the legal space?
Yeah, so I followed a trajectory that I think many lawyers do, and that is to go from law school to a clerkship if you can land one, to a big firm job if you can get one. Yeah, if only because of it can provide great experience and training. But while on a beach in the Republic of Palau somewhere between 1995 and 1997, my wife and I decided to, when we got back to the States, move back to Michigan. And as soon as we made that decision, our thought was small firm. Mm-hmm. And I'm very glad that we made that transition, and love the environment of being in a small firm as opposed to a big firm. There's just so much more freedom and independence to practice the way you want to and sort of kind of have your own schedule.
Well, those heartstrings from Michigan must have been pretty darn strong to pull you from a tropical paradise all the way back to Michigan to practice law.
That's true. Although we do say in full disclosure that the Republic of Palau is about 10 degrees hotter than paradise. and it was actually the sense of community. Palauans. So Palau is a former U.S. trust territory that became a sovereign nation in 1995 with a U.S. form of government, and they literally imported Americans like myself to help handle the government's legal business.
Uh-huh.
Beginning of their run as a sovereign country, but it's a community based country. There are 20,000 people, you know, they all sort of know each other, and there's something about the community feel that we appreciated in Palau that drove us or led us back home, I should say, to Michigan.
Well, tell me a little bit about that experience, because first off, I'm going to have to look up where Palau is.
Yeah. Southwest of Guam.
Okay, so way out there in the Pacific.
19 hours of flying to get there. At least 20 years ago, that was the case. I can't imagine it's any more easy to get there now.
And I bet you're not landing in a big, gigantic plane on the island.
True, true. There was jet service, but maybe one or two flights a week.
Okay.
Literally a one-stop-like country. There was one.
And so what kinds of things did you do to help the government get set up?
Well, the government, again, because of its relationship to the U.S. As a trust territory for so many years, it had a kind of an ingrained U.S. system, and it had an independent judiciary. It had a bicameral legislature and an executive branch. And so my range of work, and this was about 5 years out of law school, included literally prosecutions for people where the assault of weapon was a coconut, to dealing with some really vexing issues like a bridge that had just been retrofitted by an American contractor collapsing between two of the islands, causing deaths, and 100-some Filipino fishermen being pulled in by the Palawan patrol boat with issues then of what to do with these guys who were illegally fishing in Palau's waters and needed to be repatriated rather than filling up Palau's humble jail. So it was a very interesting range of legal work, something where, you know, we all tend to specialize pretty quickly once we start practicing. And it was a joy to have such a range of different legal assignments.
Sure. Week. And fascinating being, you know, relatively new out of law school.
Yeah, it was fun. There's a little bit of an expatriate community in a situation like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there were a handful of us working there, most of us American, a couple of young Palauan attorneys who've stayed, and one of whom is now one of the judges in Palau. There was a real esprit de corps sort of experience. I often refer to it, even though I was an employee of the Palauan government, as sort of like a legal Peace Corps opportunity.
Yeah, I can see that. So then you pick up and you come back to Michigan and you decide to go into small law, a smaller firm. And tell me what your experience was like when you did so.
So I joined a firm that has enjoyed a reputation as a firm that represents people who've been harmed by misconduct and does so selectively. We are not a high volume firm. We've never wanted to be. We are not on a growth a pattern toward a doubling our size every few years or anything like that. And what I found, Neil, I think pretty quickly, and one of the reasons I think I gravitated toward it, was that it allowed me to kind of realize my kind of true reporter self, in that in a small firm that represents people harmed by misconduct, you in many ways get to be the investigative reporter and a compelling storyteller. And so I, not unlike what I did as a reporter when I was enjoying that career, you know, I have to decide what leads to pursue, and where to get information, and what stories ultimately to tell. And the thing I like about it, and I tell my friends from my reporting days about it, is that unlike when I was a journalist, I get to tell those stories, and I have subpoena power.
Right.
So you know, ultimately, when those stones need to be turned over, you have a few more tools in your tool belt than you do as a journalist.
Well, I'm delighted that you framed it that way because, well, let's face it, you know, big time personal injury attorneys get a negative rap in a lot of places and sometimes well deserved. But the fact of the matter is with catastrophic injuries, there's always a story, and it's always a human story. And to the extent that the attorney can tap into that human story and get the decision maker, whether it be a judge or a jury, to empathize and understand what that story entails, they're going to be so much more successful than somebody who's just a fierce negotiator or a pound the table type of blowhard. And so of those successful personal injury and catastrophic injury attorneys that I have met, the ones that are able to do the best storytelling are the ones that are the most successful. So I would think that your journalism background there would absolutely assist you in that regard.
Well, I would hope so. And I think, you know, lawyers probably make a mistake by bloviating too much. And one of the things that you need to do in this area of law more than anything is listen and hear what has happened, and then try to figure out, you know, why it happened, what wrongful conduct caused it to happen, and whether, you know, something can be done about it.
Client selection is important too, is it not?
Absolutely. And again, one of the things about being intentionally small is that you also are kind of intentionally lean in terms of overhead. And, you know, to make that all work, you also have to be, quite mindfully selective about the cases you take. We probably investigate about 5% of the cases that we could take, and then, you know, maybe take on one out of every five cases that we at least do some investigation on. So you have to be that selective in order to be successful, you know, for the clients who you do represent, and also to be successful as a business.
Now, so you joined an established firm that had a very reputable history in the market there, and my guess is that when you did join, that this historic firm was doing business the way it had done business for some period of time.
That's true.
And which isn't all bad.
Yeah, you are correct. Yep. Yeah. And the firm burnished its reputation, you know, really in an era that preceded the advent of the internet and technology and computers. So transitioning the firm to one that, you know, uses kind of cutting edge technology and flattens the curve, so to speak, for, you know, taking on the complex cases with the use of technology and all, has been sort of one of the things that we focused on in recent years.
We were talking about this the other day with the conclusion of the Perry Mason reboot on HBO, and the recognition that back in the day, and in particular personal injury firms, although I sense that there was less specialization then, there was more generalization in those days, but law firms had their own in-house personal investigators, private investigators. So when you got a case in, you would have your investigators sort of track it down and do all the research and help determine whether or not it was a case that you were going to accept. When you got back to Michigan, was that the kind of mode you were still in, or you started to move away from that?
Well, that certainly existed in the market. It was not sort of the approach that our firm took.
Okay. But was not unheard of.
Definitely not unheard of.
Yeah. So I just find it interesting to make that connection, because most folks today think the private investigator works either on behalf of the victim or works on behalf of the police. They very seldom think that they work on behalf of the attorney.
Yes, that's true.
You know,
that's
kind of interesting. So okay. So you step into this firm, and now you've been there for quite some time. Tell us a little bit about how you've seen the changes with respect to a modernization of a storied, you know, firm. How you've seen that progress over time?
Happy to do that. So picture, if you will, maybe in the first 10 years of my practice, me trying to negotiate, you know, three bankers' boxes of documents through the sidewalks of Seattle for some big depositions of a, you know, major hotel company that we were suing over on behalf of a client who'd been catastrophically injured in Mexico on a trip from Michigan, or taking on a for-profit school in another state that had defrauded a bunch of Michiganders in a certain way, and just the difficulty managing the information and the data and the documents. That, I think, you know, now is so much easier than it was, you know, just in the last 10 years, certainly in the last several years. But starting about 10 years ago, we made the decision to just scan everything that comes in and out the door. Mm-hmm. And that led us into an era where I have found, you know, particularly in the last 5 or so months during the pandemic, that I can continue my practice as long as I have an internet connection, including managing, you know, thousands of pages of documents, really from anywhere. And so those days of headaches relating to documents and files and banker's boxes can really, I think, be a thing of the past for any, you know, solo small firm practitioner who, you know, puts the time and effort into to decide that that's the way that they want to practice.
And frankly, it's a hell of a lot more efficient, not just in terms of size and, you know, having to carry around 3 banker's boxes worth of junk, but, you know, there was a time when you had to have a paralegal or a legal assistant, particularly if you were going to trial or if you were trying to focus on a deposition, who would be working that database, if you will, trying to pull up the relevant, you know, document and hand it to you so you can, you know, continue your examination. That's a cost and a skill set that now just is addressed by a search.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the qualitative and quantitative benefits of using technology as a solo small firm practitioner are, you know, there's really almost no limit to how much better the practice can be in that regard. And, you know, the quantitative involves economics and also just management of data.
Right.
And the qualitative is in part just the freedom that, you know, being disconnected from the physical space and the you know, the documents themselves and all, you know, has challenged us in the past. It's just that you don't have to deal with that anymore.
Right. And it's more than just scanning stuff and putting it on a hard drive. You've got to come up with a system of managing it and being able to access it. So what do you use, some specific tools to assist you in that regard?
Yeah. So I think, you know, obviously, I'm sure your listeners probably already do scan and use a ScanSnap and get their documents in the cloud. And the question is, once they get there, what, you know, what do you do with them?
Right.
I have probably 3 or 4 programs that I use, you know, every day to manage the information that I am getting in the cases. And again, you know, for me, what I'm trying to do ultimately is to determine what the story of the case is, mm-hmm. and what happened. That often involves, you know, developing a timeline and a detailed chronology. Yep. And probably the breakthrough piece of technology for me in that regard in the last several years has been use of a software called Case Fleet. And I'm just a happy customer. I have no connection to the company, but the beauty of Case Fleet is that it allows you to not only get those documents into a system, all cloud-based, and link those documents to sort of a in chronological order in terms of the facts that you can pull out of those documents to sort of tell a story. But then most importantly, and this is the key, you can go back into your chronology and then click on a link to the document that supports that fact in your chronology. And this was something that users of CaseMap, for example, have had for years, but CaseMap has always been a server-based, Windows-based,
right.
Office-based, you know, technology. And CaseFleet, for someone like me, who like you as a Mac fanboy, has allowed me to basically do all of that, but do it in the cloud, do it, you know, anywhere, and it just is a game changer for me.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by our good friends at Ruby, and returning to the podcast, our friends at Spotlight Branding. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And for those of you who have listened for some time, you might recognize that returning to the sponsor position here with our podcast is Spotlight Branding. And Spotlight Branding, as you may remember, I was a client of theirs for many months, if not years, before they became a sponsor of the show. So I speak from experience that if you're looking to build content for your practice and have that managed for you in terms of blog posting, social media posting, email dissemination, email newsletter dissemination, that you can do no worse than Spotlight Branding. They're a terrific resource to draw upon, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship of this podcast. I met with the folks from Casefleet at the last live ABA tech show, which one that was. And I've been meaning to get them on the program because it's a great platform for exactly what you're talking about. Because as you said, and for any type of litigation, the storyline, the timeline is so important. And right. Being able to connect documents with events on the timeline, being able to pull them up and be able to do full text search on right. the documents in that repository, being able to pull out the fact patterns is just, you know, it helps you build your case and present it in a way that's very intuitive and very, for me, it was very graphic.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I needed that because I was building timelines literally by hand.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, so was I back in the day. So speaking of graphics, you know, another one that I use almost every day is MindNode, and that's my favorite mind mapping app. But you know, one of the things that you know, litigators of all stripes, you know, really need to do is kind of visualize their case and all the branches, all the fact, you know, all the lines of inquiry, all the witnesses, perhaps. And MindNode is something that I'm in every day to just sort of visualize my cases and the witnesses and the different things that need to be perhaps pursued. And again, this is something that, you know, pre-technology, pre-iOS or, you know, Windows software, you might be doing on a giant whiteboard in your office.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. We used to call it a whiteboard.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And now you have the ability to have it, you know, be an unlimited whiteboard that you can, you know, manipulate with your fingertips on your tablet or, you know, with your mouse on your computer. I mean, it's just invaluable.
And I know that MindNode works across multiple platforms, doesn't it? Even being an Apple fanboy, I'm pretty sure that it's supported on Windows.
Sure it does, but yeah. You know, I am not here to say it is the one and only mind mapping
software. No.
Anybody, you know, who wants to do this in Windows is going to have 25 different products.
And also, I think they also have a web based version of it. So you could, you know, wherever you are, whatever computer you're on, you could get on the web.
Yeah.
So
every product that I use, Neil, I think I use it on multiple platforms.
Okay.
iPhone, you know, Mac. Yeah. Many of them, I do have a PC at the office that I dust off every now and then.
Right, right.
And they're, you know, they're all...
You use the computer that's at your, you know, reach, within your reach.
Right.
Whether it's your tablet, or your phone, or your laptop, or whatever. Yep.
Right.
You know, I've used mind mapping applications in the past. I just, it hasn't really got traction with me personally, but I know people, which is odd too, because I'm kind of a graphic oriented thinker, but I'm an outline oriented writer.
Yeah.
And so for me, the outlining is what I tend to gravitate more to. Can you export from your mind map to outline?
Yes, you know? You can.
Okay.
You definitely can. And yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, it really is more now with technology, that the number of different arrows you can put in your quiver for a particular use case that you might have is what's so wonderful, and how, you know, you're not having to lug them around.
Right.
I mean,
so you mentioned CaseFleet. You also mentioned MindNode. Is there another tool that you use a lot of?
Well, I'm going to just mention three quickly, and that is Notability, Evernote, and OneNote.
Sure.
And the reason I mention all three is that they all essentially are means of creating notes, but they all have their different, you know, uses. And just to have them all at your, you know, available in your computer or your tablet is just a luxury that none of us really had 10-20 years ago. But I love them all. Evernote is sort of my giant file cabinet in the sky. Right. And with tags, I can send things directly from an internet, you know, browser result to Evernote and find it. OneNote is, you know, for those who really love their trial notebooks and their pages and their sections and things like that. That's easily created now digitally in OneNote. And Notability is sort of my go-to program to create notes, like, you know, basically on an iPad with an Apple Pencil. It has character recognition. It does have recording capability. And, you know, it's sort of my legal pad without any sort of page limits or yellow lines.
Yeah, I think all three have value, as you said, in your quiver of tools.
Yeah.
I mentioned this again just recently. It might have been last week on the show. Brett Burney is just a master of OneNote, and he creates trial notebooks in OneNote, and they look like works of art. They're unbelievable. And I started using Notability with the very first version of it. And I found for me back in that time frame, the best use was in depositions.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you said, it had that recording and time tagging ability. So I, in a deposition, would be taking my notes and recording it right along with the court recorder. And it was extremely useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, we've talked about the solo small firm perspective. And, you know, these are all things that we can use, I think, to level the playing field, you know, because in that deposition, you know, your counterpart might have had three associates with him or her making notes, but you might not have had that. Yeah. In your practice, but you know, you were able with technology to do things that, you know, your counterpart might have, you know, been using two other people to
help. I know one of my first depositions, you know, when I walked in with my laptop and my iPad, and that was it. And opposing counsel was there with the whole office computer system and the banker's boxes and, you know, two staff members.
So yeah.
it was just glaringly obvious that that was the way I was going to go from there on out.
Yeah. Well, so in that regard, go ahead.
Tell us a little bit then, given this movement towards incorporating technology into a, you know, as I keep referring to a historic or a well-known established firm, how has that influenced staffing?
It's reduced staffing. We've had a couple of people retire in recent years, and we've found that you know we don't need to have as much staff in our at our building. I mean, for sort of on a somewhat unrelated note, but it's probably a good illustration. Our longtime office manager who did our bookkeeping retired, and we went to a virtual bookkeeper, which is something we talked about on the show before, without sort of missing a beat. You know, there are just frankly less need to have somebody, you know, from 9 to 5 in a physical office than there was, you know, 15, 20 years ago in a law firm, I believe, these days.
Sure. Are you using virtual receptionists or other virtual assistants?
I use virtual receptionists to handle sort of the initial intake. So if you call my number and you you'll hear me and you'll hear me say, if I've never spoken to you before, press 1. And that's 9 times out of 10, maybe 99 out of 100. That's that person who's never spoken to me before as a prospective client.
Right.
And they reach a Ruby receptionist who you know, does a good job of taking a brief intake to allow me to then assess, you know, whether it's the type of case that we might be able to help with. And instead of leaving a voicemail or getting me or, you know, somebody in our office having to put down everything to talk to that person, they're immediately talking to a virtual receptionist.
So that, you use Ruby in that way. You also have them do the intake questions.
Right. Just a sort of brief script. It usually takes, you know, 5 minutes or less. You know, again, the person who's calling, who's never spoken to me or my firm before, but has some reason to be calling us rather than anyone else, is always then going to be speaking to someone immediately and who wants to hear, you know, what their cause of concern is, who the parties that they believe are responsible, you know, for the problem are, and, you know, gets me information in a matter of moments that I can then respond to.
Well, it's no surprise that, you know, Ruby is a friend of the program, a sponsor of the program, and been with me for a long, long time. I'm a Ruby client. I was a Ruby client before we started the podcast. And not everybody recognizes that, aside from just answering the phones and shuffling the call off to the appropriate individual, that they have that capability of doing intake. And to the degree you can refine your script, you can make that a very efficient process. You know, the criticism is sometimes they're a little more expensive than other you know, for other tools. But
yeah,
I find that it's really up to you to refine what you ask them to do so that you get the biggest bang for your buck.
Yeah, I agree. And I actually, you know, can attest to the fact that I think the slight additional cost is worth it. When I was first beginning this a couple of years ago, I was actually toggling between Ruby and one of its competitors. Mm-hmm. You know, I would just change the number that the caller would get forwarded to between the two services that I was demoing. And I just found overall the quality of service that I was getting from Ruby was the best. And they also have an app and you know, a portal on the web that make it easy to kind of review the data that you're receiving from them.
Yeah, one of the things that I do, not to get into a Ruby commercial here, but one of the things that I do is they also host my phone number so that when I return, if I'm calling from my home office using my cell phone, the number that the client sees is my office number, or if I text them from my cell phone from my home office, the number the client sees on their text message is my office number. And so that keeps that privacy in place. And for a lot of firms, that's really important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's then, you know, wrap up here and talk about marketing, because again, back in the day, you know, lawyers marketing was taboo. And, you know, you're just expected to get clients as a result of the good work that you do. How has that changed for you over the course of time?
Well, in several ways. When I arrived at the firm in 98, we didn't have a website. I don't know that, mm-hmm. you know, many law firms might have at that point.
No.
You know, now, as an example, you know, we have several websites, and they're, some of them are targeted to particular practice areas, yep. that we use. When we do have a kind of a landing site for our firm with our firm name. I have my own site, because one of the things I found was that, you know, people would search for me on the internet trying to find me, and, you know, might not immediately, due to Google's results, find our firm's website. So I have a website. That's one way, is just to sort of recognize the value of having kind of micro sites, mm-hmm. Out there. You know, I think we're still probably more in the camp of referral marketing and word of mouth marketing being the best for our brand and what we do at our firm. But we have done some class actions, for example, where, you know, we hear from an aggrieved student who's been ripped off by her school in some way. And we know that there are probably other people out there with similar problems at the same school who are looking to find somebody to, you know, discuss their legal problem with. And we've used Google Ads and again, sort of microsites to find the have those people find us.
That's interesting. And, you know, that all makes sense when, if you have a firm that's been around for a number of years, it built up a huge reputation, quality reputation. You're gonna get referral marketing results from that, and you'd be silly to ignore that. So that makes all the sense in the world. Thomas, I want to just chat briefly with you about one other thing that's in your background, I know, and it's really kind of something that we talk about here on the program as being a reason for this podcast to exist. And that's the, you know, answering the question what they didn't teach us in law school about running a business. And I've always maintained that the bar associations, frankly, don't really carry their weight when it comes to training and providing services for attorneys. You have a long-standing history of serving in the leadership roles for various bar associations, going all the way back to your earlier years in Michigan. Give me your perspective. Am I wrong, or am I just too critical, or I'm willing to be wrong, or is it changing? And what's your perspective on that issue?
I'm happy to address that, and I don't think you're wrong. I do think that part of the problem is not that the bars aren't doing enough. It's that they're not doing enough to get the word out about what they are doing.
Interesting.
Yeah. And yeah. I
tree falls in the forest kind of thing.
Yeah. And that's part of the same. I mean, bar associations, I have found, having served on our county bar and ultimately been its president from 2014 to 2015, and now being on our state bar board of commissioners, you know, longstanding bars with decades of service to their communities and to the public. But like law firms, they, you know, have been doing things a certain way, you know, for a long time. And I think there is disruption that bar associations can benefit from, just like there's disruption that law firms mm-hmm. can benefit from. And with the pandemic, for example, we have at the state bar level been trying to get the word out about the services that are available to lawyers to learn the basics of, handling Zoom calls and Zoom video conferences with courts, the resources that are available in practice management. But, you know, they're frankly often hard to find on a website, or there's something that you're not being immediately reminded to do. So I think a lot of the challenge at the Bar Association level is providing clear messages and information to its members and to the public about what resources it does have.
Ironically, here in the state that I practice in, Maryland, the pandemic has actually created a lot more, in my humble opinion, a lot more progress with the State Bar Association in providing resources and keeping the membership informed about what's going on. They've really stepped up to the plate. And as critical as I have been of them in the past, I have to also be fair enough to say that this is a perfect example of what a bar association can do and should do. And they've done it, and they've done it in spades. And one of the criticisms, and I suspect that's also true there in Michigan, is one of the criticisms of the bar has been that it's been too big city or urban centric, that it provides a lot of resources to, say, folks in and around the Baltimore area, as an example, but very little by way of the solo practitioner in the rural parts of the state. Is that I'm assuming that's a challenge for the Michigan bar as well.
I think it's a problem that any large bar association could fall victim to. I'm proud to say, I think in Michigan, both at our county bar in Oakland County, where I practice, and our state bar, we are very mindful that the vast majority of our members are solo small firm practitioners. Mm-hmm. And we try to, we try to recognize that and act upon that. But, to your broader point, Neil, about what's going on in Maryland now and the good things, I do think that in times of crisis like this, and we can't forget just the pain and difficulty that the pandemic has caused, it also is a time of great opportunity. And, both bar associations and firms can pivot at times like this that, can lead to better things for the future. And I feel that's certainly the case for solo small firm lawyers with the technology that we've discussed. And I think it's something that we're seeing at the, bar association level as well.
Well, that certainly has been my experience here as of the last few months. And I'm happy to say that and publicly do so publicly. Anyway, yeah. Tom, it's terrific spending time with you. We could chat and talk about our other favorite Mac tools and how we use them in the law for a long time. But tell our audience how they can reach out to you and follow up with you if they have any questions or interests that they want to share.
Sure. Well, happy to receive a phone call or text to my office line, which is 248-502-0862. Email me at my office email, which is thowlett@gugasian.com. thowlett at gugasian.com.
We will have all of that in our show notes, and I'm happy to share it. And Tom, I want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, thank you. I think I've listened to more episodes than you broadcast, and that's because I've listened to some of them more than once.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, and I appreciate your support.
All right, take care.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility, and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.